Hey there, this is Sarah Smarsh, and I'm the author of Bone of the Bone, Essays on America by a Daughter of the Working Class.
Sarah Smarsh has been writing about political and socioeconomic issues through the lens of her rural upbringing for over a decade. Her new book, Bone of the Bone, is a collection of some of her previously published essays, which showcase her skills in both journalism and creative writing. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Sarah Smarsh. Bone of the Bone is a collection of 36 of your essays, if I counted correctly. Some are political, some socioeconomic, previously appearing in various publications presented in the order of publication date. Can you give our listeners a brief description of this collection? How did it come about?
Well, those 36 essays come from about a decade of my most recent work. And over the course of that decade, I was kind of expanding my journalistic contributions into the first person personal narrative. I'm a trained reporter, but sometime around a decade ago, I started offering a more intimate glimpse into my identity and my views on socioeconomic class and how that intersects with gender and also place. I grew up on a fifth generation wheat farm west of Wichita, and that farm and that experience looms large in a lot of the essays, as it did in my first book, Heartland. But there are also, as you note, pieces of political commentary, several kind of subgenres of nonfiction or the essay, if you will, that some of my readers might be new to and see me kind of taking on different forms.
Yeah, we can't talk about all of the essays, but I would like to touch on a few. And as you mentioned, not all of the essays are political commentary. In one titled Believe It, written for creative nonfiction, you touch on skepticism, disbelief, amazement, and such when it comes to memoir. You wrote, "In matters of truth, much has been said of the memoirist's responsibility in wielding accuracy. Much less has been said of the reader's responsibility in wielding belief." Can you talk about this?
Sure. So while I just got done talking about my having begun as a reporter, I'm really an artist at heart. And since I apply my work and my writing in service to, I hope, broader discussions about very important topical matters like class and economic inequality, I don't very often get to talk about craft, which is really, you know, what I'm up to behind the scenes. And that piece for Creative Nonfiction, which is of a fine magazine devoted to that genre, kind of a writer's magazine, and also just publishes a lot of fine work that anybody would enjoy reading. Around that time, it wasn't long after that shift I made into leaning into the first person narrative. And so I guess it was top of mind for me how people were receiving my words compared to people who had various types of privilege that I didn't, like along gender or economic lines specifically. You know, I have been fortunate that I have always had enjoyed really a lovely and overwhelmingly supportive and validating response to my work. That said, a lot of times editors specifically early on in my career would, I guess suspicious might be too strong of a word, but would be maybe a little bit dubious about the claims I was making that there is such a thing as rampant classism in this country, or rampant what I would call placism in this country even. And the reason that those blind spots and doubts exist among gatekeepers is, of course, that it's a largely privileged industry in economic terms, and also one that tends to be centered in urban coastal centers. So yeah, and so that essay documents how, you know, race and other kind of power structures impact the way that we sometimes subconsciously come to a given narrative and whether we give it credence or not. Often that process has a lot to do with our own comfort in the world and whether somebody's story is challenging that comfort.
In the essay Poor Teeth, you talk about how in 1903, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote, "The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line." And you wrote, "The problem of the 21st century is that of the class line." And then you elaborated in a footnote because, as you say, the sentiment warrants elucidation. Talk to me about the color line and the class line and the timing you mentioned.
Yeah, sure. So when that piece came out in 2014, that was actually, I believe, the first of my essays to, as we say today, go viral. And I don't recall anybody taking issue with that line throughout the essay, and paying attention to the way that class intersects with race and other aspects of gender. And I don't like pitting any particular identities or types of injustice as though they are oppositional or somehow unrelated. They all, of course, intersect and intertwine. I guess if you don't mind, I might just read that footnote. I added it because I thought 10 years on, and as I've gotten further into my discussion of class in this country, I just thought it was a good opportunity to add a little note on what I meant by that statement you just read. Is it okay if I just read that footnote?
Absolutely.
The echelons of American power have artfully pitted class and race concerns in opposition to one another to disastrous effect. In the interest of rejecting that false dichotomy, I avoid framing interrelated forms of injustice as separate. Meanwhile, both race and class are specific identities in their own right. While I can recall just one or two readers taking issue with my assertion that, quote, the problem of the 21st century is the problem of the class line, end quote, the sentiment warrants elucidation. My statement, and the Du Bois statement to which it alludes, names the century in which society will have no choice but to finally, collectively address a system of oppression. While racial injustice remains common in 21st century America, and while Black people, Indigenous people, and other people of color resisted racial injustice for centuries prior, the 20th century saw a post-slavery United States dismantle Jim Crow laws, give rise to the civil rights movement, codify protections for people of color, and reject white supremacist foundations in cultural ways that still reverberate. Such a moment has not yet arrived for class injustice in this country, but amid historic wealth inequality, I believe it will arrive in this 21st century.
You know, we mentioned that the dates of these essays range from 2013 to 2024. And just like that, when you made a few footnote additions with any updates that might have occurred after publication. Other than that, have the essays aged well? How have they aged?
Well, it ended up, I don't think I wholly answered your initial question, which is like, how did this book ever come about? One doesn't imagine that one's essays will be collected in book form 10 years later. And so along the way, I was just kind of weighing into the discourse in earnest. And then I had so many essays out in the world, and a lot of them had been well received that my editor and I talked about putting them in a book. And so then that gave an opportunity to find out if they aged well, as you say. And I believe they have. I intentionally approached editing or revising or updating with a light hand. I wanted these pieces to reflect the moment in which they were written. That said, a through line abides, I believe, and that's that my voice and my concerns and my position have remained consistent. And I was talking about these things like class and place before in more recent years, and in political frameworks, it was fashionable to do so.
You know, some of the essays that stuck with me are The New Migrants, Freedom Mandate, and Liberal Blind Spots, specifically when you wrote about how many Americans today have a glut of information but poor media literacy. Are there any from the collection that continue to stick with you?
Wow. I would say that the essay we just discussed, Poor Teeth, is the one that I still, in very specific ways, hear from people the most about. After that essay came out, I heard from, I'm not kidding you, Beth, thousands and thousands and thousands of people, not just in this country, but around the world, who wanted to talk about class and also in some specific ways, dentistry and access to it as a class signifier, which was kind of like the organizing angle. Or maybe springboard to talking about class and classism in that essay. So that one has definitely had legs, and I hear from educators who have it on their syllabi, and that's always an honor. I would say also, and this also comes from that same year, about a decade ago, I wrote an essay called Dear Daughter, Your Mom, in which I'm specifically talking about gender and the way that that intersects with poverty and my experience having been a first generation college student, leaving the farm and leaving a legacy of teen pregnancy that I come from, was born to all those cycles that I broke and how painful it was to do so is documented in that piece. And I believe that in that essay, I really tapped into the voice that readers would find in Heartland or some of my most personal and intimate work. And so it feels special to me in that way. And then I guess I would say, all of my work for a lot of my essays for the New York Times and The Guardian, and in more recent years and in this political moment, I think of as sort of, well, they're certainly of a piece with each other. And also, I might say, from my perspective as a writer, I'm basically just saying the same thing in different ways to people that haven't quite yet gotten the memo that not everybody in a so-called red state is wearing a MAGA hat, and not everybody in the working class is a white man, and not everybody in the entire friggin' region of the Midwest, or let's say all of rural America, is the same type of person politically or ideologically. So that sort of larger project, I guess, of pushing back against narratives that erase the nuance of the place that I'm proud to hail from, is probably in more recent years feels like the real force behind my work.
You know, we talked about how there are 36 essays in this book, and one piece that is not in the book is the guest essay on the New York Times opinion page from August 7th, after Kamala Harris named Tim Walz as her vice presidential pick. It's titled, "Democrats Have Needed Someone Like Tim Walz for Decades." How does having someone from the Midwest on the ticket benefit those in the, quote unquote, flyover country that you write about all the time?
Thanks for that question. So first, let me note that, and this I feel like is an opportunity to let your listeners know that writers and journalists do not headline their own pieces. And I actually think that that headline the Times gave that was a little bit in how I would have framed it. They said Tim Walz is like somebody the Democrats have needed for decades. It suggests that there's never been someone in that party who, speaks from a rural vantage or with a lens on our region. And that's not the case. I a few years ago had the privilege of meeting the Montana Senator John Tester. On one of his hands, he lost three fingers in a meat grinder, and he comes from a long line of farmers. So Tim Walz, nonetheless, is I think certainly rare for his class background and his place background, and specifically his presence on the top of the ballot as a vice presidential pick alongside Kamala Harris absolutely feels historic and like nothing I've seen in my 44 years. And, I think that as someone who considers place and class, and I believe those two things are intertwined in a lot of ways, to be a really under-discussed aspect of identity and the American experience, and I might even argue diversity. I think that if the Democrats are hoping to make some inroads in those places that have previously been sort of left on the table as quote unquote red states, maybe unworthy in their national calculations of resource investment, I believe that the selection of Tim Walz seems to suggest that they're changing their strategy. And I believe they'll find that was a good move. I personally, when I see Tim Walz and I hear him speak, as I describe in that Times piece that you noted, he looks and sounds and feels like a lot of the men that I grew up with, good, decent men who have been allies to marginalized peoples of various sorts, and yet who, because they're middle-aged white men in the middle of the country, are presumed to have a certain kind of politics that actually, once again, doesn't represent everybody in this area, and it doesn't even represent every white man.
This is maybe a question about craft. You received undergrad degrees in journalism and creative writing from KU, and I mentioned this because these essays were essentially written for print, but you read them aloud to me as I listened to the audiobook and read the print book simultaneously. How did the essays translate to audio, and what was your experience reading your own work aloud?
Oh, I love this question because I have now narrated three of my books as the reader of those audiobooks. And thank you, by the way, for taking in the book in two different formats. I always find, and was no different with this book, that the reading of a piece of work taps into some corners of the heart for the writer, in this case, me, that feel a little bit closer, or sometimes maybe even more unsettling if what I'm recounting is an unpleasant experience of my own, even trauma. That's a long way of saying it. It was an emotionally exhausting exercise, I think, and I hope that that's just all the more validation that what I brought to the page and what I offer the reader or the listener is something very true and real and intimate.
Many of these essays are personal, and you write that you are one of the most private people you know, and that while these essays vary in different ways, not one was published without you becoming nauseous at the thought of it being read. So, how do you feel about a collection being read?
Oh my goodness. Well, it's some the just absolute blessing and privilege of a book coming out is so surreal for someone who spent summers working in wheat fields growing up and was raised by folks who left school in sixth and ninth grade. I can't say that I've even like processed it in the ways that are more readily available to my consciousness in, writing a one-off piece that, as you say, makes me nauseous when I think about someone reading it. So far, no bouts of nausea with Bone of the Bone, the collection, but maybe it just hadn't sunk in yet. And I tend to find, though, that once something's out in the world, and maybe that's why with this book, there's only one new. Well, I wrote a new introduction, which you just quoted from, and then there's one long new piece at the book, and the rest, while they likely will be new, most will be new to a lot of readers. I have already gone through the experience of having them rolled out into the world, and so it's sort of a unique experience, a collection of work from the past decade.
What do you hope readers will take away from this collection?
I think that my hope for Bone of the Bone is the same hope that I hold anytime I use my voice, whether it's speaking to a group of people in a lecture hall or publishing an essay or publishing a book. Well, it's kind of a twofold hope. One, if someone doesn't know the place or the people that I am trying to portray with some accuracy and dignity, that they feel their eyes have been opened up to some extent, and that maybe they learned something and had a blind spot removed or remedied. And what's probably the most special experience for me when it happens is that folks for whom they already know what I'm talking about very well, they lived it, they know it firsthand, and they've been yearning for someone to articulate it, that folks living that experience feel seen, feel understood, feel validated in their complexity and their beauty and the nuance and the fabric of their place and their lives.
Well, the book is Bone of the Bone, Essays on America by a Daughter of the Working Class. Sarah Smarsh, thank you so much for joining us again today.
Beth, thank you so much for having me.
That was Sarah Smarsh, author of the book Bone of the Bone, which was published by Scribner. If you are in Wichita, Sarah Smarsh will be here on September 24th at Grace Presbyterian Church for a reading and signing. Tickets and information are available at watermarkbooks.com. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Books and Whatnot is a podcast for readers, where we talk about the titles we've read lately and those bookish little discoveries along the way.
You know what, Beth? I have just realized what my favorite new genre is. And my favorite new genre is WTF.
It is.
Listen to Books and Whatnot every month from KMUW, part of the NPR Podcast Network.